So this is what it feels like to be in the presence of greatness, eh? I feel very honored.
Oh, don't be like that.
Do you think I mean it?
He was talking about him, guy.
Oh, yeah. Holy crap. Buttering up the toast before we even begin.
Oh, yeah. It's just I know how rough you can be, Mr. English. I need to make sure you're gentle with me. Yeah, I've been watching your Twitter stream, and apparently you don't interrupt enough, so I'm expecting a lot of interruptions.
Yeah. I'm just going to let you talk. Won't say a word.
No. You can't do that. Because yeah, we'll be here forever, and it's your job to decide when I'm being really boring, which can be really quickly and really easily. So,
okay, you know what? Let's just roll into this. Scotty, good to have
Guy.
You. Like, you know what? The first time I ever did a podcast was on one of your shows. It was in a roundtable. Yeah, and you told me I sounded like I was in my bathroom.
Which because most probably, people did in those days.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a mic or anything. And not that I sound great these days, but like I had a maybe shitty iPhone headphone mic.
Well, people just really weren't used to talking on Skype and anything like that. It's and the round tables were a nightmare because we'd often have 8 or 9 guests on Skype at the same time.
Yeah.
Which was a complete chaos, and I was a complete idiot, but there we go. Nothing changes.
It was a lot of fun. I got a lot of value out of it, and I listened to them, but the contributing side of it was a little bit rough on me.
Yeah, it was challenged, wasn't it? And people kept talking over themselves. But no, they were fun days, and the early days of podcasting for me back there in the late 2000s or whatever it was. The roundtables were fun, and that's actually where I met a load of people through the roundtables. Was sort of really quite selfish. You know, who would I like to talk to? Who would I like to meet? Oh, let's get them on and give them a reason. Let's pretend I think they know something and find out if they do.
So we totally stole your thing.
Yeah. Yeah. No. It's
exactly what we do. Yeah.
I think, you know, things move on and things change, and there's a, lots of people sort of better at different things than I am in whatever, but they were fun days.
So let's rewind, which is one of my favorite things to say. It's funny. People have been giving me like crib notes on what I should be saying like during the podcast. So now I'm all like self-conscious, but
you could ignore them if you want to. I didn't know if they'd help.
Oh yeah. No, I don't care. I'm just
screw those
I'm
guys.
Just, I'm just like more conscious of like, at one point I'm going to say that's bananas, and somebody's going to fill out a like a bingo card.
No, it's a drinking game, guy.
At 10 a.m. I hope not. So how did you get into the game, Scotty?
Totally by accident. As a kid, I hadn't really been into computing at all. I wasn't, you know, you have all these guests on your podcast who sort of say, you know, and, you know, 5 years old, I had a computer my dad brought home, and, you know, I really hadn't been that interested as a teenager. I did have a ZX81 computer that, my parents bought me when I was about 13 years old. I don't think you had the ZX81 in the States, or it might've been marketed under a different name, a Sinclair computer.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was a sort of a fleeting moment. It lasted, you know, the thing was useless. You couldn't do anything with it. It had sort of 1K of RAM, and I think the processor was a 3.25 megahertz processor, unless it went into slow mode, in which case it became about half a megahertz. And I think slow mode was whenever the screen was enabled. So, which was all the time, in other words. So that kept me entertained for about 10 minutes. Because my family wasn't technical at all. I'm from a working class family. So yeah, my parents had never touched computers. They still haven't to this day. So I hadn't really been that interested, and I totally screwed up high school altogether. My grades were terrible, and everything was really bad. And so at the end of high school, I went to the Social Security office to sort of sign on for an employment benefit. That was going to be my future, which was great as an 18-year-old. And it's amazing. Social Security offices around the world all looked as depressing as each other.
Well, so what was up in high school? How come you didn't agree with you?
I did fine until I was 16. In the UK, we have two stages of exams when I was there.
A-levels?
You had exams you took at 16 right? years old, O-levels, or ordinary levels, as they were called then. I did okay there. And then for A-levels, you start to specialize between 16 and 18 in this country. I did maths, physics, and art for A-levels. I totally screwed up the maths and the physics, and I just about scraped through art. So, there was no way I was going to be going to college based on, you know, those results. I don't know. At 16, there was something about, you know, for up to the age of 16, you'd had teachers saying, you know, come on, these exams are important. And you just get through them at 16 and you just sort of say, oh, done. And immediately someone's saying, okay, you've only got 2 years till the next ones. These are important. It's like, oh, yeah. I really don't care.
Yeah. I was the same in my youth too. Like,
yeah.
I was studious in that I would read whatever I found interesting. But, you know, if you tried to apply me towards something, like especially like an O-level, A-level kind of thing, no way. Like it just the I would get bitter and I just wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah, I mean, the stupid thing is I really enjoyed math. I just never turned up to any of the lessons.
Right.
Which made when I sat down in the final exam at 18, it was like, nope, never heard of that.
Right.
So it wasn't great. So really I had no idea what I wanted to do with my life. And I headed off down the Social Security office to sign on for an employment benefit, which, my mother must have been so proud of me at that point. And, I got there and, the sort of person without the sense of humor behind the glass who you always find in these places sort of told me that I couldn't sign on for this benefit yet until I'd had a careers interview, which didn't please me because the careers office was right the way the other side of town. And so I wandered across to the careers office. And when I got there, I queued up and met somebody. And then they told me I didn't need a careers interview because I was over 18. So that didn't make me happy either. But then I was just turning to walk out and she said, but while you're here, we might as well do one anyway. And so I just went into an office and she sat me down and she said, you know, what are you interested in? What would you like to do? And I had no idea. And it was just sort of, you know, I'd been playing maybe a little bit of a Commodore 64 sort of games or something, you know, recently. I just said, I don't know, computers might be quite interesting. And she went through one of those old fashioned, you know, green and white line dots, you know, matrix printer printouts that she had of basically every community college in the country and what courses they ran. And she sort of, she found a course in computer science in a community college in a city a couple of hours down the road from where I was and just said, well, this place has got some spaces left on their course. This was sort of September time. And I said, I've totally screwed up school. She said, but yeah, they'll do an entrance exam. So I think that was a Tuesday. And so she rang them up and, said, okay, they'll take you for an entrance exam, but the exam's tomorrow. So, they got on a train and went off to, it's in Cardiff in the UK, in Wales, and, went there and I sat the entrance exam on the Wednesday, and had an interview. And then on the Thursday, they gave me a call back and said I had a place on the computer science course. So Friday, I went back to Cardiff and found somewhere to live. The Sunday I moved into the place and I started the course on Monday. And that was it. I was then hooked. So it was a really well planned out career.
And did you take to it like right off the bat, or was there like a, you know, like did you have to adapt to like the way of thinking, or did you just sort of get on the horse and go for a gallop?
I don't know. I did sort of just take to it. It was a really good course actually, and we covered obviously it was an incredibly practical course. So we were taught to program. So I learned C, Pascal, and COBOL at the time. I mean, this was 1985, so you know a little while ago, and it did operating system architecture and hardware architecture, and I just found it fascinating. And I was obviously already quite a logical thinker, and it just sort of fitted with me, and I just got more and more interested the longer the course went on. And so, you know, by the time the course finished after a few years, you know, it was, you know, that was it. I decided that's what I'd like to do, at least for, you know, until I come up with some other plan later on in life. And 26, 27 years later, whatever it is, I'm still doing the same stuff. So I've obviously not had any other plans yet.
Yeah, not a bad idea. You still working in COBOL?
No. I can't remember what
I actually like COBOL. It's not as crazy as people make it. Well, it's not great, but
any language where you can just put caps lock on and go for it.
Right.
Hockenberry would love it.
Exactly. Yeah. Data section. You have to indent what is it? 8 spaces. First 8 columns are for comments. It's great.
Defining all your records with pick statements. Pick XXX.
Oh, yeah.
999.999.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
I mean, it's an incredibly crap language, but if you want to start at the top of a very large file and do something to every single record and finish at the bottom of the file, it is actually really, really efficient. And that's what it was designed for do. I mean, as you say, banks use it still. It was designed as a batch processing language. I mean, yeah. I guess today we would do lots of the jobs that we've done in COBOL. We do in a scripting language today or something like that. We'd knock up a script, but it was great at doing that stuff.
Yeah. And it was actually pretty readable. I mean, despite all the goofiness
despite being in uppercase. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I can't remember. Was uppercase a convention or was it required? I can't really remember.
I'm pretty sure you needed to write like data section in caps. That's the only thing I remember.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm pretty sure. Exactly. I think the keywords needed to be in caps, at least. But you know what? They had by the time I stopped paying, well, not that I paid much attention, but they did have an object-oriented COBOL at some point.
Was it Microfocus? Microfocus did one. And they even did COBOL for .NET, didn't they?
Yeah. And I mean, that's bananas. I did it. There you go.
That's just completely mad.
Yeah, that is pretty – it's crazy. I don't know why you did it. But it's interesting. So this is 85, you're saying, right?
Yeah, I was in college. It was a two-year course. It was called a higher national diploma at the time. I think they call them foundation degrees these days. So it was a couple of years. So, yeah, between 85 and 87.
So you're basically hitting it. Pretty much a sweet spot in terms of where the industry is and your introduction to it.
Yeah, I think I was just thinking about this morning, and yeah, I think this has been a really privileged era to live through. Because I mean, the 60s and the 70s were really quite experimental, and we read the books now and we listen to what's going on. But really, all the stuff that was going on sort of in secret government labs or you know, very large companies that we were never going to get near.
You're not going to go hang out in Bletchley Park or something.
No. Right. And then even that time, Wozniak and Jobs and Gates sort of in, the late 70s or whatever, it was still really, for quite a small and exclusive club, really, that I would probably, someone who just said, oh, it might be quite interesting, would never have been able to get involved in, or would have had, been harder to get involved, especially being a rural person. I was not living, I definitely don't live in a Silicon Valley area. So really having lived through the time where computing began to be accessible through to now where it's sort of just taken for granted has been a real time I think we'll look back on in history as a real sort of a revolution. We'll look at it in the same way that we looked at the Industrial Revolution now on this sort of last 20 years. So it's been great fun, and having the opportunity to work with things, from COBOL and Assembler and all that stuff through to where we are now it's been great, because it means, every couple of years I'm changing what I'm doing, which has been fun.
Right. So what was the first machine that you worked on? With the first job that you got in the industry?
My first job, I was writing accounting software that ran on Unix, Convergent Unix at the time. This is back when all the different Unix were still sort of proprietary Unix systems on the whole.
This is before Linux or FreeBSD or anything. This is Unix was at Unix. Yeah.
Yeah. And this was really before networking was standard in companies either. So the Unix boxes people were running software on were normally all with dumb terminals with serial cables running back to a serial port on the machine.
Nice.
So or some sort of serial setup. Yeah, so it was a accounting software, which is about the most boring place you can start, on Unix. It was in COBOL, using Vi as the IDE, the extensive IDE at the time. it was all those days. I don't know if you've ever worked in an environment where you had to submit your compile to a batch compile and then it sits in the queue and waits. So there was lots of coffee drinking in those days where you waited for the compiler to come back 20 minutes later and tell you you'd missed one full stop, and that's accounted for your 47,000 errors in your COBOL code. One full stop could always do. But it was, it was really crappy software, really, but all software back was in those days. And, I can't even remember what the file format was, but I just remember that if you were attaching records to an account or something, it was all done with relative record chains. Mm. And so somewhere those things would sometimes somewhere in the software go wrong. So regularly the software engineers will be sent out to customer sites to go into some of the secret screens to manually change record pointers in the database.
Oh man.
To fix things again. And it was crazy stuff. I think, so there were six of us in the department, and I joined as a junior developer. It took me ages to find this job, probably about 6 months. I think I applied for about 300 jobs. Really the industry wasn't like it is now where they just need people who are interested. It was quite hard to get into. Right. And obviously there was no internet to search for these jobs. I'd never heard of agencies and hadn't discovered them. So I was sort of visiting towns within a sort of 100-mile radius and buying the local newspaper and applying for the jobs in them and that sort of thing. Wow. It sounds like I'm from sort of the dark ages, doesn't it? But I joined this department.
Before the internet, yeah.
And so this company was run by a CPA who'd sort of designed this accounting software, and he was a complete maniac, this guy. I remember being in a meeting once and someone had done something, and it was really minor in software terms, but he just put his head in his hands one day and just sort of then shouted, how can I soar like an eagle when I'm surrounded by turkeys? And it was just, he was a real motivational boss. And I'd been there, I joined as a junior developer.
Like something out of like Alan Partridge or something.
He was just like that. He was just like it. He was a crazy guy. And I joined as a junior developer on a really, really crap salary, even in those days. It was about about $5,000 a year or something. Which even then was a really poor salary.
Yeah.
And there were six people in the department, and I'd been there about 6 months, and everybody apart from me quit. So I suddenly became head of department in the place, and had to recruit a new team. And so I went from junior developer to sort of 6 months later, recruiting people, being their boss, running the department, having no idea what I was doing, making it up as I went along, which is basically what I do with most of my career.
Sure.
And, so it was a pretty heavy learning curve, really. But actually turned out to be quite good fun.
And so how old were you?
How old when I was that?
Yeah.
Yeah, I must have been 20.
Yeah. So that's young to be taking on that much responsibility.
Yeah, I don't think I realized how much responsibility I was taking on.
Yeah. Well, that's probably the way you could do it, frankly.
I just did it. And it was basically, it gave me the freedom to sort of do what I wanted to do in the software and do it the way I wanted to do it. And,
that's how you learn, right? Just like sort of jumping into the deep end and getting it over your head.
Yeah. In fairness, it's only so much you can screw up the COBOL, but there we go. it's pretty rigid in what it does and how it does it. But I was working there, and so that was my beginning in the computing industry of working for the man, as they say.
So where'd you go from there?
Okay, so I was there for a couple of years. I think that's the longest I've ever stayed in a job, was 2 years.
Oh, really?
In fact, I've only ever had two jobs, and I went indie, or contract or whatever. So,
wow. Okay.
From there, I got married, and we were living in the southeast, myself and my wife, and it was during a house price boom in the UK. So really, we could, with the salaries we were earning, even though I was now head of department and earning a decent salary.
Yeah. Late 80s, early 90s?
Yeah, late 80s, still late 80s, sort of 89-ish probably. We could afford a shed somewhere in the back garden if we really maxed out on a mortgage. Interest rates in the UK at that time were 18% on mortgages as well, which was like, I can't even believe anybody bought anything, but there we go.
In the UK were pretty rough, right?
They were Although I'm still very fond of the 80s, and I keep thinking, yeah, the 80s were great, and then you'll watch something on TV from the 80s and think, no, that wasn't good. And then you'll hear some 80s music. No, that wasn't any good. And eventually I'll find something that was really good about the 80s, but there we go.
Spitting image.
Yes, that was funny. I was talking about that with someone yesterday. There we are. Mm-hmm. So I went from there and I went into manufacturing, actually, manufacturing computing and mainframes, because that's where, you know, the PC really still wasn't that common on the desk at this point anywhere. So, I went into mainframe computing, still mainly in COBOL, initially. Got involved a little bit later, got involved with PL1. Ever used PL1 from IBM?
I haven't used it, but I am aware of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I actually quite liked PL1. It was a strange little language, but used by about seven
people. It's effectively a scripting language, right? It's sort of the predecessor to Rex, maybe?
I think Rex was based on some of its syntax, but it was probably more of a COBOL replacement. Okay. So lots of people use it in the same place. And obviously, it was mainly on IBM mainframes I was working, although I did do some ICL and some VAX work as well. It's a lot of batch work, but then using, Kix, or do you pronounce it Kix in the US, or did you say CICS or something like that?
So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I've only ever read that. So CICS,
Kix for its day. When I think back of it now, and the mainframes that we were using in those days were pathetic as far as processing power is concerned. I mean, they were these huge boxes in these huge rooms, and yet, you know, your iPhone probably has as much processing power as some of them had even back then. And yet they were, you know, in the banks and everything and in the manufacturing, supporting hundreds, if not thousands and thousands of users on systems doing stuff. It is pretty impressive. Using IBM's Kix software, which is basically like using REST APIs for everything as we would do now, but in a more proprietary format. But it was incredibly efficient, incredibly horrible to write for. But think about it, I was quite impressed. You take data and you pack it up in a transaction, and you'd have a little program for every part of what you were doing. So if you wanted to read some data, you'd issue a transaction, and then you'd issue another transaction to put the data back, and issue another transaction maybe to save the data or whatever else. And it was everything was tied up in these sort of data maps that would map in every transaction would map to a small application back on the mainframe that would just get an instance of it would get run just to process your application.
That sounds quite sane, actually.
Yeah, and it would scale massively on what we would consider these days really, really crappy hardware.
Right.
It's mainly character-based information, still on dumb mainframe terminals. The fact that you could run so many users off what was pathetic hardware really is was quite impressive. So I worked with that for a couple of years in the manufacturing industry, and then we had kids, and all the cost of living went up, and I still wasn't getting paid enough. And so it was the middle of the recession in 1992, I think, in the UK. So I decided to quit my job and go independent.
Of course. What else would you do?
it was a sort of a do or die, really. It was like, there's, developer wages, and they still are in the UK, are really not as good as they are in the US. Right. I think wages in general aren't as good in the UK, but, you know, in our industry, the difference is huge.
Right.
It's massive. So, it was a case of, especially if you're outside of London, I guess a bit like, you know, if you're outside the valley, there's big differences. Mm-hmm. But, it was a case of, you know, there's no way I'm going to find a job right now that's going to give me the sort of pay rise I need. So let's do something stupid and go for it, or just, you know, flunk out doing it, really. So I just went contracting, really, still working in mainframes and everything. But one of the joys of I found a contracting is you just get to visit so many different industries and do so many different, learn about so many different things that are going on that I just really found that fascinating.
Right.
But it was just finding, I think back now how we used to find work. There used to be a, because obviously the internet still wasn't really, around in any form that anyone was using properly or fully at this point.
Yeah, 92. I mean, you've got Usenet, email.
Yep. Yeah.
BBSs are still big, but I mean, you don't have, like, the internet as we know it today was just really not a factor.
And it's equally, in the UK, I think we were quite a long way behind sort of that sort of usage of things as well. So I think things like CompuServe were kicking off a little bit around. And, but again, we're still 2092. What are we at? About Windows 3, maybe?
Yeah. I think
maybe
it's
at that point.
I think it's 3.11. Like yeah. 3.11 is out. But you know what? If you want TCP/IP, you still got to install WinSock.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
If I'm not totally crazy, I'm pretty sure that's the time. Yeah.
So I don't think I even owned a PC then still. Couldn't afford one. That's why I was quitting my job. or anything like that personally. So, we used to find work by, there was a contractor magazine that was printed every 2 weeks with just lists of contracts in. And then you go through it and ring up the ones you're interested in.
Wow. Were it specifically for software or just any kind of job?
No. It was, I'm trying to think what it was called. It was called Contract Weekly or something, and it was all about computer contracts, and you could subscribe to it and it was free, and it came through your door every 2 weeks and you flipped through and made the phone calls. It was you can't imagine that now, can you?
I can't. I do like that though. It's got an old timey appeal to it.
Yeah.
So not that I want to do it, but yeah.
You were allowed to make a phone call. You didn't have to write a letter. So it was quite modern. It's in there. But yeah, so I basically traveled all over, because obviously most of all the work in those days was still on site. There was virtually no remote working for this sort of work. So I ended up working.
Was that rough with your family?
Yeah, but you know, it was horrible. And I'm not sure if I was making the choices again now, I would do the same. I mean, we survived. That's the point. We weren't going to survive the other way, and we did survive, but it was pretty rough. I remember, because we're in the middle of a recession here, so I went to Scotland to work for quite a lot of time, because for some reason they had work there. And you know, I do remember coming home one day and my wife just saying to my son, you know, say hello to daddy, and he just went and picked up the telephone. So obviously there were some consequences to that, but you do what you do, don't you, to survive?
Right.
So it's in there. So did that, but at the same time, I worked for some great companies. Worked in the distilling industry for a little while, doing some of that stuff. So I learned lots about whiskey, which was fun. in underground transport and a little bit of military stuff, and worked quite a lot. I did quite some long contracts for the nuclear industry, and that was quite interesting actually. And, quite scary as well sometimes. Just, you know, seeing what went on in there.
I bet. So, how is the nuclear industry in the UK? I know France is like a lot of their energy comes from nukes. In the 80s, Thatcher basically killed off coal mining in the UK. I'm not really aware where most of the power for the UK comes from. Is it predominantly nuclear at this point?
I think I haven't worked in the industry for a long time now, but it's I think we were about 20%.
Okay, yeah. So it's not rare. It's
not rare, but at the same time, it's one of those hot topics still. And the industry is, you know, it's an incredibly expensive industry. And the standards put on it are so high and so tough in this country. I have no idea what they're like anywhere else. I mean, the whole reason I first got a project there was, putting a new system together to look at, the maintenance of the wiring within a nuclear power station. And in an average nuclear power station is something like about 2 million miles of wiring. And, every wire has to be checked no matter what it is at some point during it. You know, they have different maintenance schedules, but you know, there are teams whose job only is just to check the wiring. And we were doing some of the systems for that initially. And it's, you know, it's just crazy the amount of overheads and things in that. But I guess if it's nuclear, you got it really.
Right. It's crazy. Yeah. Maybe it's just sane how much they check it all, but still.
So that sounded to me like, we're checking all this stuff. And then at the same time, you've got all these engineers in the reactor room saying, I wonder what happens if we do this, and they'll write a rec script to change something on the reactor. They'll just write it there, and they'll say, "Let's run that against the reactor and see what happens." And it's like, okay,
really?
I'm sure you know what you're doing, but it's like, I say that, yeah, they were probably changing stuff that was so, as far as they were concerned, so within tolerances and not within tolerances. But when you're just for some sort of reason, you'd have to visit the control room of one of the stations just to work something out, be with them, and you just hear these conversations, you're thinking, I hope actually, because I can do that with code sometimes, and I know that I'm being a complete ass, so I just hope you're not being the same.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to get into like a Homer Simpson situation where he's like dragging a control rod home or something, you know?
But it's crazy because, you know, the standards on a power station are just so tight that actually, for the majority of the UK, if you were to take a stone out of your garden or your backyard and take it into a nuclear power station, it probably wouldn't be allowed to leave because the amount of radiation coming from it would be above tolerances that were allowed to leave the station. Mm-hmm. Which is, you know,
that's a misunderstood thing, is that there's radiation pretty much everywhere.
Well, there was a spillage, from the spent nuclear fuel is transported in the UK on trains. In fact, I did a project on that. I might talk about it in a moment if you're still interested. But it's, if you're not asleep by then. And so they're spent nuclear fuel is put into, big steel containers, and they're full of water. Mm-hmm. And then they're transported by railway. And one of the power stations, there was a spillage where the container hadn't been bolted properly, and all of the water that was surrounding the spent nuclear fuel poured out of the container onto the railway siding. And so, you know, following the rules and the laws, it was, they sort of had to dig the ground down 6 feet and either side 6 feet, and, you know, take out a huge chunk of sort of ground under the railway siding, and then bring soil back in, and then bring all the stones that go under the railway siding come in. And because of where the stones came from in the UK that they put back onto the railway siding, the radiation levels after they'd finished repairing it were higher than after the
Yeah.
And that's the crazy world it was living in. But actually, that was my first foray into Windows programming, because I was a mainframe programmer.
Oh, perfect. So you're running Windows to stop the nuclear apocalypse.
And I was sat there one day doing something, and someone came round. This is the way it all works in the industry. Someone said, we need a new application to control the transportation of the spent nuclear fuel from the power stations to the recycling plants. We think we might start moving it into Windows now. Anyone up for doing it? And I said, yeah, I'll have a go. I'd never done anything. I later discovered they wanted it done in Paradox for Windows, which, was interesting. I don't know if you ever got to use that, but,
I was aware of it. I didn't get to use it. Sorry, just as an aside, where does the UK bury their spent fuel?
All the fuel is processed at a plant called Sellafield, which is somewhere in the north of England, and I should know exactly where it is, but I can't remember. Okay. So basically any power station in the UK, and I think we accept spent nuclear fuel from other countries as well, because that's the type of, you know, nation we are, and it gets all transported by rail. Everything's got to be done by rail,
it's like all mineshaft kind of thing. You just drop.
No, it's actually, yeah. I think the fuel gets reprocessed. I think a lot of the radioactive material can be reused. And then I think there's some products from it that can be reused and goes back into the system, and then there's a lot of sort of waste product out of it as well that I think then gets taken a long way out to sea and dumped.
Perfect.
Don't quote me on that, nuclear industry, but I think that's what happened with it. Yeah.
Okay. So Godzilla is in progress.
Yeah, but I think we bring it close enough to you guys that it probably comes your way.
That's what I'm hoping. That's great. Yeah.
Hey, we've always liked to be a good part of the world.
So you're working in Paradox for Windows. Paradox is a relational database, right?
I think relationals being to is file based database.
Sure.
From Borland, it was the successor to DBase.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, so I think I actually used the same engine as DBase. Borland had this thing called the BDE, the Borland Database Engine, which had two native file formats, one of which was DBase and one of which was Paradox. And that survived for years. That became the main database driver in Delphi, depending on which side of the Atlantic you come from, as well. But Paradox worked with this language called Object PEL. I think PEL stood for, when Paradox for DOS servers, PEL stand for Paradox Application Language or something. And they put together an object version for Windows. And in fairness, I quite liked it at the time. I mean, I can't forget, I was coming from PL1 in COBOL at this point. So this object-oriented, what we probably call an abomination of a language today, I find quite fascinating in learning a lot of object-oriented techniques.
Well, Borland actually did a lot of really good work. Stuff is pretty interesting.
I always saw Borland, looking back on them now, Borland were a really technically solid company that just had no idea how to make the most of what they had.
Totally agree. Yeah.
So I got involved in writing this app that, as far as I know, always worked while it was in commissioning. So I never heard of any, fuel being lost. It's all about scheduling and all that sort of stuff, because when you move nuclear fuel, you have to have to make sure there's nothing else on the railway line. The army have to be informed. The police have to be informed. All different people have to be informed. And it's all about making sure the right stuff's in place at the right time and all that sort of stuff. So it's more business than it sounds. But it was great. And I thought, this was still Windows 3.1 at the time. Probably 3.11 Windows for Networks, whatever it was called. Yeah. Windows for Workgroups. I think it was on a Novell network. I don't know, because then networking was more.
It wasn't even TCP/IP. They had their own wacky
NetBUI or something, wasn't it? Something like that.
Token ring.
Yes, and cables going everywhere. It was networking was just a killer. It was just terrible in those days, but there we are. We just need to be thankful for what we have now. Which I don't know why, because TCP/IP was around, wasn't it? It just hadn't been adopted as a standard, because TCP/IP is probably one of the oldest protocols.
Yeah, it was still a Unix thing. I mean, PCs and stuff were still using like null modems and like weird, crazy hacks like that. You know what? I think the TCP/IP stack was probably bigger than, you know, like the kind of cheap hacks that you would do to get networking working.
Yeah, and I guess I guess Windows was probably, because Windows at that point was still an application running on top of DOS.
Yeah.
So I guess by the time, the machines it was running on, by the time you had DOS and then you had Windows, probably putting a TCP/IP stack in it was going to kill everything or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that stack would have been a big addition, right? Like, in terms of lines of code, it could have been like 50% of like what the actual operating system was, just to get the stack working. Anyway,
TCP/IP come in with it? 95 had TCP/IP.
95 had TCP/IP built in. Before that, you needed WinSock. OS2 had it in before that.
Yes, I loved OS2.
Yeah,
I was so sad that it's a.
I know. Okay. Right.
I guess it did survive, but in a way, because, Windows NT and OS2 were the same kernel, weren't they? But it's I liked OS2 as it was in its day.
Right. So did you use it a lot or what?
I did. I used it on my own machines, and I did some of my own stuff on it, using the Borland C++ compiler for OS2.
Mm-hmm.
Which the Borland C++ compiler was the most amazing piece of software ever to buy, because you would order it, ring up and order it from somewhere, or you'd possibly order it online in those, just about by those days, and it would turn up in a box at least a yard long full of manuals. And it's like, if you're going to buy something with a big box. And it was amazing. Right. When it's, you felt like you'd really got something for your money instead of this little, and it's 22 floppy disks or whatever it was on. So I did bits of it for myself there. But actually, I did all my Windows 3.1 development on it, using the emulation, because it was actually far more stable than Windows 3.1.
Yeah, you know what? Quite a few people did that. In fact, I did a bit of that too. not that I programmed Windows much, but I used OS 2 obsessively. It was just a better operating system. If you didn't want to play all the games and all that, which I could reboot into DOS to do, OS 2 was just better.
Yeah, I mean, it was preemptive multitasking, and actually it even segregated your Windows environment. So actually it made Windows 3.1 better than Windows 3.1 ran on just when running right. by itself. So
because when Windows app would crash, it would take out your computer. When a Windows app would crash on OS 2, it would take out the Win32 app that was running, basically. And then you could just restart the app.
Yeah, and it did all this crazy stuff like if you're trying to run Windows now and on a Mac and you're using something like VMware or Parallels, and it does this what's the mode called? Coherence mode or something where it tries to just make the app appear as an app on the screen. It would do all that sort of stuff. And yet we're here back in sort of, you know, early 90s, and when, you know, this we take this stuff for granted now. That was, you know, major stuff. But
just to clarify, you would have like Windows 3.1 looking Windows mixed up in your OS 2 desktop. Like it would they would run kind of seamlessly. They did such a good job getting that working.
Am I right in saying you could even have multiple copies of the same application running, which you couldn't do under Windows because it would only ever run the same one all the time?
Yeah, you could. Yeah.
There we are. But it died. There we go. It stayed around until about 2000, though, didn't it? But
you know what? They turned it into E something. I don't know. They renamed OS 2 to like eCelerate or something. Like there was some weird thing. But they started plugging in as like a Java environment.
Oh yeah, that's when everything goes wrong, isn't it? When this becomes a Java environment.
Yeah. And you know what? Windows NT 2000 was good. I think it was better, mostly because it fixed all the dumb stuff with Windows, and it was better than OS 2 in a couple of ways. Do you remember OS 2 would block? It had a single event queue. So if one app stalled on, let's say, like a keyboard event, if you pressed a key in one app and it would block on an event, all of the other apps wouldn't receive events. So effectively your system died. Bad design.
The OS 2 and the NT kernels started the same, didn't they? They were the same because Microsoft were working for IBM on the joint project developing the kernel.
Yeah.
And that went on to become the NT kernel.
Yeah. So in the file, HPFS, the OS 2 file system sort of is the progenitor of NTFS, the current Windows file system.
And I did when I did start running Windows NT quite early, but as long as you didn't want to do too much on it, it was really far more stable. But you just couldn't run anything. But the main issue was always drivers. You could never get drivers for NT.
Right.
But there we go. But it was better than Windows 95. So when Windows 2000 came along, eventually that was a good move. But there we go. Jumping on. But yes, was it OS 2? It was called OS 2 Warp, wasn't it?
Yes. Warp was OS 2 3.0.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and so I think the last effective one was 4.0. I'm sure they had more after that, but it didn't matter.
Yeah, I think once things became 32-bit on the Microsoft world, I'd probably, because I wasn't doing OS 2 work itself, I'd probably sort of moved on a little bit by then because you know, I was trying to do 32-bit stuff and whatever
so,
else.
So. You were working in how'd you like Delphi?
At the time, I loved it.
Yeah.
I thought it was probably that and obviously the early Visual Basics, although I thought Delphi was a better implementation. Mm-hmm. We're probably beginning of programming as we know it now.
Right.
Can
we describe Delphi? It's basically Object Pascal. Right.
Yes, yeah, it's Object Pascal. So, which is basic Pascal with single inheritance, effectively. It was an incredible. The compiler in Delphi was amazing. Even I think for Delphi 1, which was still Windows 3.1, so 16-bit. So you still had to do all your memory segmentation stuff in it and everything.
Yeah.
But I think it would compile something like 100,000 lines a minute, even on the old machines back then. I mean, it was an incredibly fast compiler. It was amazing.
Borland was really good for that. Do you know what they would compile to an intermediary code, and then all of the object files would be in this intermediary code, and then they would link them all together, which is why the compiler was so fast. Like Pascal, they had a Pascal and a Turbo C++ that did the same thing.
Yeah.
And the reason I'm bringing it up is that LLVM actually sort of adopts that model now. LLVM bytecode does something very similar. Yeah.
And I think with all Borland's compilers, they compile. So if you use Borland C++ or something like that, they will compile to the same intermediary code. So you could then link all the files from different languages together for your final executable if you wish to.
Exactly. Yeah. Borland, well ahead of their time.
So that was Delphi was Anders Halsberg was the main designer of that, and Delphi had the VCL, the Visual Control Library, which I guess was effectively Delphi's version of Coco, which was at the time a really well designed library, and worked really well, and just allowed you to do things. And if you'd done any obviously early Windows programming in just C, whatever, you were still doing all the crap like setting up your message loops and all that yourself. The Win32 API, the Win16 API was just horrendous. And then even then, if you use something like MFC, Microsoft Foundation Class Library, MFC stands for, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I think Borland's was called OWL, wasn't it? The Object Windows Library. But even using those in C or C++ was, it wasn't that pleasant an experience. So then to suddenly get something like the VCL, which began to just allow us to do things like we might be used to now, to have a button and put a click event on it, to have a form, have text fields and just make them work was like such a huge step forward.
So it was brilliant. Around this time, I was working in the game industry, and one of the secrets of the game, especially at that time, because it wasn't yet common to just buy an engine and a tool chain. So we would have to create it all. And a lot of the time, the tools that I had to write in Win32 with like event loops and all that were garbage. But then I went out and got Delphi, and the tools that I could write with VCL in an afternoon were amazing. I loved it. It was one of the first sort of – you know when you have that sort of come to Coco moment when you're like, oh man, I totally get this. It's awesome how fast I can whip something up. VCL was sort of like my first experience with that kind of, I don't want to say obviousness, but like that sort of like accelerated development ability. It felt like Visual Basic, but for advanced programmers, because Pascal, you could do whatever you wanted, really.
Yeah, so you still had to learn. I mean, it was a proper language. You had to learn memory management, and you had pointers, and you could do whatever you liked with it. Yeah. But equally, you had this pretty good IDE and this pretty good editor.
Right. I'd come up with Pascal, so like that, the Delphi thing wasn't a leap. But I think people think of Pascal as like Basic Plus, but it's not. It's effectively C. You can do pretty much anything you can do in C in Pascal.
I'd say it's C without the case sensitivity.
Sure. Yeah.
There's very little you could not do with it. It's because it's a full language. I remember the VCL had this. It was amazing that things. If you were writing a control, writing your own custom control for it, you had a whole bunch of code you could put in there because. The you could write your controls to respond either when they're running in the application or when they're running in the IDE.
Mm-hmm.
So you could write code that if someone took your control and dragged it on a form in the IDE, that code would run. Whereas when it ran in the final application, when you ran it or debugged it, it would run, which meant that most of the controls in the IDE would do live rendering while in the IDE. So you could actually connect a table view up to a database table in the IDE and see what it looked like as it rendered live data from your form, from your interface builder equivalent where you were dragging stuff around and just see exactly what it's going to look like. And, that was, I'm not sure how sensible that was looking back at it now, but at the time that was like, wow, this is so cool. And to make it do stuff. So it was really good. And I wrote some lot of good software with Delphi. Delphi was one of these, I think, products that you'd have a good release and a bad release, a good release and a bad release. And I think it's all the odd numbered releases were great, and the even numbered releases on the whole were fairly poor. I think Delphi 2 was the first 32-bit Win 95 version, and then Delphi 3 was an amazing release, and then 4 was bad, and so on. I think probably the biggest system I did in Delphi is we involved in some software for some prison in the UK. The UK were just beginning to privatize prisons, and I have no idea how I got this project. I've really no idea how I got it. I mean, now I wish I hadn't, because it was a disaster, but never mind. this was going to be Britain's first private prison, I think it was going to be, or maybe there was already one, but it was in the very early days of private prisons in the UK. And the whole idea was they wanted to reduce the number of prison guards by having as much automation as possible. And they came up with this plan to have a computer system that controlled the gates and turnstiles within the prison based on who an inmate was and what time of day it was and where they should and shouldn't be. And so you could almost have free movement around the prison of inmates based on them just going to gates and presenting themselves, and the system will make a decision of what they could do or not do, which is a cool idea. I mean, it was a category A to C prison. So Cat C is like your burglars and that sort of stuff. Your Cat Bs are your murderers and your rapists, and then your Cat A's are your terrorists. So it could have anyone from that range in it. And initially they wanted to do it on fingerprints but at the time, this was still late 90s, the fingerprint readers were incredibly slow. Lots and lots of false positives, which we were trying to work around, but it was, I think the thing that finally took us off fingerprints was the fact that the fingerprint readers in those days had absolutely no idea if the finger was attached to a body or not. and you thought, just in a prison environment, the chances of someone taking someone else's finger just to go and get to the shop or something like that are probably quite high. So they abandoned fingerprints and went for tagging, for tags that every prisoner had to carry. So that was quite interesting, because this was probably sort of when Windows 95, 98 time. I think it was running on NT, but anyway, we did everything with, we were talking to the fingerprint devices or the card devices. We had to talk to the turnstiles that were moving. We had to talk with communication screens, because what would happen is a prisoner would come to a gate and present their card. It would first of all identify their card, identify if they should be there. It would take their photo at the gate. It would have their photo from the file. It would do very basic image recognition to see if it could, was this really the same person? And it was all going to be monitored by somebody as well, but it would try to be given advice that, yes, we think this is the same person or not the same person.
But using what? Face detection?
We had to, it wasn't that great. We used a custom library that actually was paid a fortune for and really didn't work. I think, it was a long time till anyone got face detection really well. Probably another 10 years. So I don't really feel too bad that bit didn't work that well. We were only supposed to be giving an indicator of is it obvious this is the same or not the same person. But it was far too early to be doing that type of stuff, really, I think. But, this stuff. But this just implementing anything in that environment was an absolute nightmare. The trouble is, everything, you can imagine what it's like at a project like that. It's got very tight deadlines, and everything's falling behind. And in a high security prison, before they're allowed to open, they have to have been operating in high security mode for, I can't remember if it's 1 or 3 months or something before they actually even take a prisoner in. And so you're moving towards the end of a project and you're trying to get everything running on site and you're trying to do everything. And then suddenly they say, as of tomorrow, this will be a maximum security prison, which now means it takes you 4 hours to get in the morning and whatever else. And it's, and if you want to move between buildings, you have to call a guard, you have to be approved, and that could take another 4 hours. So you might want to just go to a building just to see if something's switched on, and that could be your whole day gone. Implementing a system in that environment was a complete nightmare. There were a few of us on site, I think the plan was for about six of us to be on site for about 9 days to implement it, and it ended up being four of us on site for about 9 months. But there we go. And it's we just started sleeping in the cells because it was you just so I've spent many nights in prison, but I wasn't even supposed to be there, as all prisoners say, because it was just too much hassle. It was just too much hassle to get out of the prison and know it's going to take you 3 or 4 hours to get back in the next day. So wherever you were when you just, you know, you'd had enough for the night, you just went and got in a cell and just went to sleep.
That sounds crazy. I guess it makes sense. I mean, it's crazy. That's
not
just,
a lot about that project made sense.
Right.
It's
well, so much that's bureaucracy, my worst, imagine, right?
Yeah. Oh, bureaucracy. My worst project manager experience ever. There's, you can imagine what these projects are like. I was a subcontractor to a subcontractor to a subcontractor to a sub type of thing in this type of thing. And it's, I remember sitting in this meeting with one of the sort of senior project managers of the project one day. And, he was trying to impose penalty clauses for late delivery on myself and the client I was actually working for because we hadn't yet implemented the system in Building 17. And we were supposed to have implemented the system in Building 17 by the previous day or something. And he was trying to say that we now had to pay all these penalty clauses because we hadn't done it. And he did not feel that our explanation was reasonable. And our explanation for why we hadn't yet put it in Building 17 was because he hadn't yet built Building 17.
What? Wait, seriously? Like
he hadn't yet built the building that we were supposed to implement it in, but we were going to get charged for late delivery of the system into that building. It was like, and once you realize that's the sort of people you're working with, you just think, yeah, let's just not even go there anymore.
Well, you know what? The solution is right in front of you. You just put him in a jail cell, lock him up, the key, you're done. Problem solved.
Yeah.
That's kind of crazy. I don't know how you can sit there in a meeting and not just like how do you demand something get implemented for a building that doesn't exist?
I have no idea. And that's why really that was sort of the last time that I really did work for very large companies.
Right.
I'd sort of had enough because you find that sort of bureaucracy everywhere, and I started trying to find far smaller products, smaller projects to do at that time. Towards that time, .NET was beginning to come in as well.
Yeah, so this is what, late 90s, right?
Yeah, late 90s. I think .NET was starting to come out in very early beta versions around that sort of time. Yeah. I think it was finally released around 2001 or something like that, wasn't it? I can't remember. It's a bit hazy now.
Seems like it. Yeah, maybe a little earlier. I don't know. But yeah, close. Yeah. .NET is sort of coincident with OS X, I feel like. Yeah. The time that they track sort of similarly.
Yeah, pretty much. I think, now I'm in the Mac world, that sort of seems to feel about right. And of course, .NET is effectively VCL version 2 because it's the same architect. So, because Anders Halsberg went to Microsoft to design .NET after doing the VCL for Borland.
Right. They famously sort of cherry picked a lot of the really smart guys from Borland.
Yeah. They probably lost about 50% of their team over those couple of years, in that sort of area, mainly from the frame, what we call these days, the framework teams.
Yeah.
To go and do VCL. And of course, along came C# as well. And, Borland really didn't make the .NET transition. In fact, Borland still haven't made the .NET, they're not Borland anymore, whatever they're called these days. They've changed their name several times. They still haven't made the .NET transition. Yeah. So, it was, I began to move into .NET and C#.
They kind of, maybe they were the last sort of victim of Microsoft as this voracious competitor. Like Borland kind of got just taken down and taken apart by Microsoft in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and I don't think they had to. I think, obviously I'm not an insider. I think, Apple were in a really bad place happened to make a couple of really good calls that changed that. I think Borland just never made those calls.
Right.
Borland is still there.
No, like, don't get me wrong. I don't think they've managed.
Whatever they called. But,
I don't think they ran a good business. I think they had a lot of good technology, and they just got taken apart by Microsoft.
Yeah, yeah. And whether they had this whole battle over for ages when .NET came around that actually, you know, .NET wasn't native and they were still native because the VCL compiled directly against the Win32 API as it was at the time.
As opposed to the CLR, the kind of language.
The CLR and its whole native argument. But, you know, I've been doing a few talks at conferences on native development, you know, what is native development recently. And, you know, actually, in those days, maybe there was some water in that argument because the machines still weren't, I think, what were we probably your 486s, maybe early Pentiums in those days. I don't know. Maybe Pentium 3. I can't remember. It's too long ago.
P2 or 3 around there. But, yeah.
But still not huge, by modern standards, hugely powerful machines, although a lot more powerful than we've been on a few years before. And yeah, maybe it had some water, but as machines progressed, I mean, I don't think, when you move to an environment now, I think you look at native no longer to me means, you know, machine code or raw APIs or whatever. It's now, you know, native is, do you work against the frameworks that the deliverer of the OS deliver. So in other words, you know, are you developing against Cocoa? Are you developing against .NET? It's not a case of, you know, are you down at the raw metal level or whatever else? And if you're against there, you're native, is in my opinion. And I think there are, you know, I think Borland or Embarcadero, that's what they're called, still trying to hold this, we still do this native environment. And I think it's just a bad argument as far as I'm concerned.
I agree. That's a good point, actually, that native now means, not running in a web browser rather than compiling directly to machine code. It now just means like, well, you're not using HTML5. The ground has shifted enough.
I think it goes maybe, I would make it a little bit more specific than that. Cause I've been working on a C# product with the guys from RimObjects for a little while now. So yeah, this whole native argument is something we go through quite a lot, or have to deal with this. And, so it's this whole native versus non-native with the browser, not the browser. I view the argument slightly differently for us. First of all, I think HTML5 and JavaScript are native. They're native to the platform on which they run, which is the browser. And I think the browser has to be seen as a platform, not an application.
That's fair enough.
If people start viewing the browser as a platform, then
HTML5
native
is native to it. Sure.
What it won't be is native to, you know,
the host.
OS 10 or Windows or whatever else. But yeah, that's cool because the browser is far more than just an app for viewing things now. It is a platform. It's a VM of its own right. But obviously, there's lots of different things because there's, you know, this whole thing about being native or not native and this cross platform and not cross platform is, you know, it's been an argument that's been around for years, and there's been libraries such as Qt or Qt, was it? I never know how to pronounce it.
Yeah.
Qt that's, you know, around that we're doing stuff. Now, you could argue, is that native or is that not native?
Well, I mean, it's native compiled code. I mean, even like OpenStep used to run on Windows NT for a while. Not OpenStep. Was it OpenStep? I forget how they branded it. But Next had basically an OpenStep environment that would run on NT for quite a while. Was that native?
It's all a good question.
Yes, you know, right, yeah. It was 8086 code, but, you know, what does that mean?
I think, to me, native means, is it using
the frameworks provided by the system?
Am I as a user, ever going to know that this is not a native application? So, for example, does it behave the way that everything else defaultly behaves on this platform? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I use Postbox as my mail app on OS X, which is not a native application, although they've put an awful lot of work into making it look native and feel native and things like this. And it's a great app and it has lots of features I love, which is why I use it. But when you go into the text box, it's not a native text control, and therefore some of the things like Text Expander and whatever else struggle with it. Because it's not a control. So there's little things like that. So it's a far more fine-grained argument now. And then there's different things. So I think you had Miguel on, didn't you, from
Xamarin
guys, because obviously another C# producer. And you know, they've taken a different approach to what the guys at RimObjects have done, that the Xamarin guys are trying to bring .NET to as much as they can to every platform, so you can write the same code on every platform. Mm-hmm. Although they've had to, doing that, they've sort of said, okay, well, we're going to actually do that where we can and then have libraries specific to each platform for you to use in there. Whereas,
I don't know if they'd entirely characterize it as that, but sure.
I'm simplifying, yeah. And, sure. And I'm not trying to deride them or anything. That's the approach there. Whereas with RemObject C#, which is what I've been working with the guys recently on, what we've tried to do is we've just tried to bring a C# compiler to each platform. Mm-hmm. So you can use C# and the same IDE no matter which platform you're developing for. But actually, if you want to develop a Cocoa application, you're using C# against the Cocoa frameworks. Mm-hmm. If you're developing an Android application, you're developing C# against the Delve API on the Android thing, or against .NET, which means we've had to do some language extensions because we've had to change C# a little bit so it supports Cocoa multi-part method names. So it really is in there. That's been really interesting because it's been about bringing a language to a native platform and then just having it used natively on there, so you can compile. If you write a Cocoa application, it's Cocoa. It's running. It actually ends up running against the Objective-C runtime. It uses LLVM in its compiler. So at the end of the day, it's a full native application, but you just got to write it in C# instead of Objective-C, which if you like C# is a great thing. And if you don't like C# is not a great thing, but that's up to you to decide.
So, you know what, let's put a pin in that because I want to really kind of go in deep on that. But how did you end up moving to the Mac? Because we got into the RemObject stuff because of the .NET thing, but we skipped sort of your transition, and I want to sort of lay that framework and then examine this, RemObjects.
That's cool. Yeah. Sorry, yeah, I just jumped ahead of myself because I was.
No, it's good.
It was about 2006. I was pretty, I've been doing the same sort of stuff for quite a while by then. .NET had been sort of the staple for sort of 6 or 7 years. I was still doing, sort of consulting around that. And I was at a meeting for a sort of the leadership meeting for a voluntary youth organization that I was part of. One of my friends who was also on that team, he'd have sort of arrived a few minutes late because he'd just been to pick up a Mac. PowerBook G4 that he bought on eBay, a secondhand one. And it was sort of like, he sort of got out of his bag and I had this sort of, ooh, moment. And I just sort of, looked at it and I thought, yeah, I want one of those. And so I bought one on eBay as well. So it was a G4 with, I think, two gig of RAM. I don't know, something like that. I don't know what it was then. It's about 2006. Yeah. It was the last generation G4, I think. And I just started playing with it and I didn't really use it for much for probably about a year. Cause I was just playing with it and I hadn't developed for it. I did try doing my main Windows work on it using, what was Microsoft's sort of emulator at the time called?
They bought a company
still back on PowerPC. I don't know, whatever it was, but anyway, it was like developing on a donkey. It was just so slow that even though I really didn't want to keep my, I think I was using a Toshiba laptop at the time. I really didn't want to use that compared to the Mac anymore. Even I wasn't prepared to put up with it being that slow. Right. And I just sort of began to, just play with it and fall in love with it. And after about a year of having it, maybe slightly less than a year, 6 months. I don't know. I'm not very good at remembering dates. I just sort of said, I'm bored with writing for Windows and this is the machine I want to use every day. I think the Intel transition was just gone through by then. Mm-hmm. And so this will be my last Windows contract. And when it's over, I'm not going to do one anymore. And I'm going to try and bluff my way into the Mac world. So I thought, okay, let's get in there and start trying to learn this thing. So I installed Xcode. I think it was Xcode 1.5 at the time, was it?
Seems like that. Yeah, this was post-Project Builder for sure. So
yeah, it was post-Project Builder. And I remember firing up Xcode the first time. Remember, I was been a Visual Studio developer for the last 5 or 6 years, and it was like, what is this thing?
Yeah, Visual Studio is pretty good.
Visual Studio is a great – other than it's got normal foibles Windows apps have to have –
sure.
Actually, as a development IDE, Visual Studio is a great IDE.
Yeah.
And there are still things in Visual Studio I miss in Xcode now. There's things I definitely don't miss about it as well, but there we go.
Yeah.
That's a different thing. And I thought, what is this thing? This is like going back to the dark ages. Right. And I began to sort of look into it. And I think Objective-C I took to really, really quickly. I found Objective-C really, quite intuitive.
Because of the C-sharp stuff or because of your Delphi objective?
I think probably Pascal both. Obviously, the C syntax wasn't an issue to me because C-sharp is C syntax.
Sure.
You've just removed the pointers and everything. Or you've moved the fact that the pointers away from you, if they still are. And of course, the having to do memory management was like back from the Delphi days. That's not a problem.
Right.
I teach a lot of programmers over the years. I've taught a lot of programmers how to program, and it hasn't taken me, you know, well before I came to Objective-C, the first thing I do, these days before I actually teach them any code or anything else is I teach, object oriented principles, and I teach memory management, because whenever I've come across code of people who've just picked something up, those are always the two things they have no idea about and always why they've screwed their code up. And even now I do that, even with Arc, I'd still probably do that because, you know.
Well, I mean, the dirty secret about memory management is that it's not memory management, it's resource management. If you're going to open a file, you got to close a file. If you're going to open, you know, allocate some memory, you got to free the memory. Like it's a basic pattern that is common, not just for memory,
so
many things, right? Yeah.
Always amazed by you'll meet developers sometimes who've been creating objects and whatever for, you know, a reasonable amount of time as a developer, and they've no idea that by doing that they're allocating memory. And I've been quite surprised by this over the years. And they've no idea what's going on there, and it's just like you describe, you know, you begin to, you know, even though they may not be using them, you begin to describe pointers and memory allocation and how freeing memory actually doesn't free memory, it just releases it into the memory allocation table, and that's why sometimes things still work. And suddenly you see the lights go on, and it's like, okay, now you'll start writing better code.
Well, I think you're a good teacher, because those sort of first principles should be like that's foundational, right? That's just how the computer works. And
but it's always been the same. I think you read lots of blog posts and people don't just saying that when they wrote their first Cocoa app, they never bothered with retain and release stuff.
Right.
Or, you know, in the Pascal days, people just never, you know, they do create, but they never do free. And retain release is a lot easier than create and free. A lot easier. Of course, that bit was reasonably familiar because, you know, sort of interfaces in Delphi, if you're working with an interface as opposed to an object, they worked on retain counting as opposed to, whatever. So I had the concept of, retain counting was, although it worked differently, was familiar with me. So actually I found that transition really very simple. I'll tell you what I struggled with the most is and not because it was complex, it's just simply for some reason it took me a while to get my head around it, was IB outlets and actions. Because it was so different that it just it took me a while to sort of, and once I got it, I fell in love with it.
Yeah. So let's describe how it works in Delphi. It's sort of like the Visual Basic method where you would basically double click on a button and add your action code into the button, effectively into the like a callback,
the form class that the button was on, because basically Delphi, like .NET, you descend from the window the form class, and that's your form, and when you double click a button, it basically creates an action method on that form class, which it links somewhere in the background without you seeing it. In Delphi, I think it used to do it inside the form file itself in some code that you never got to see. And I think in Visual Studio, in .NET, it generates code in the section that you're never allowed to touch.
Yeah.
But they're both very similar. The way
comment-based markup stuff that's wacky. Yeah. Now in Objective-C, as I imagine many of our listeners now use, we, you know, we have the responder chain and targeted actions. And in a way, it's kind of similar. I could see why you would expect to be able to double click on a button in Interface Builder and then just type some code. But it's not quite the same thing, because in Objective-C, it's really about sending messages rather than calling methods. And like, that's a bit of a weird, it's so close, but it's just enough of a difference that I could see it tripping people up.
But until you understand that about Objective-C, and I make the mistake all the time, I still call them methods on objects. It's just long. And I know.
I mean, the implementation is called a method. What you do is send a message. Which
you send a message as opposed to calling a message. Yeah.
Right. It gets a bit wacky, but whatever.
Yeah. But I'm so glad it didn't double click. I'm so glad Xcode wasn't in a position or Interface Builder that you double clicked it and it did it, because I'd have probably, it would have. What I had to do is understand it. And once I understood messaging and the way it linked up and it made sense, you can then use that to your benefit and you can use that to your advantage and write good stuff. If you don't understand it, it's really quite hard.
Right. I mean, the responder chain is brilliant. And I'm really happy that they haven't actually caved over the years, because especially like around the time that you're talking about, when there was a massive influx of people coming in and a lot of them didn't really get the responder chain kind of design pattern, it might have been easy for them to just hack Xcode into doing what you're talking about, which is just like you double click a button and you can write some, you know, action code. But they haven't folded on that. And I think that's for the benefit of the platform.
No, and I think that's really good. But this was, say, probably this was late 2006. And you know, I don't know if everyone who's been in the Mac world for a long time sort of knows this, but you know, the amount of resources available to .NET developers, when they were coming to .NET in the sort of mid, you know, from anywhere from the early 2000s through to the late 2000s was enormous. I mean, there were just so many websites covering this stuff, so many tutorials. Microsoft themselves, fantastic documentation all over the place.
They've always been really great at that.
I was one of many, many writers for MSDN, you know, and just regularly get an email saying, you know, we need an article on this for the MSDN website. You know, here's how much you're going to get for it. Will you write it? Yes, no, bang. And it was just masses of it. So
that's cool. I wasn't aware they went outside the company for that stuff.
Oh yeah, you get tech edited, and boy, are they rough! They really are rough. if you're a bit soft skinned, you don't want to write for their tech editors, because they absolutely murder you when you make mistakes. But yeah, no, they literally use lots of people to fill their own content on this.
Oh, that's cool,
and make it all work. And often they're doing that even during they will do that during beta phases, and then throw all that stuff away when it goes live and do it again. And they invest an awful lot into that sort of thing, and it's great. And I think, you know, there's a lot to be said for that. So coming across to Cocoa, and there was nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was Cocoa Dev Central. That's Scott Stevenson, wasn't it? And, what's the site
got sucked up by Apple at this point.
Yeah. What's the site that, the wiki that, Stephen Frank started and then got taken over by? Joshua Nozai recently. I can't even remember what it's called now.
That was a good one.
We'll find out what it was. So that was, and there was one podcast, because I'd just gone into podcasting at the end of my .NET days. I was doing a .NET podcast with some friends called Four Chaps and Blighty. And so I sort of thinking, oh, is there a podcast? And there was one podcast, interestingly, called Cocoa Radio, because I know Justin Williams is just starting.
Yeah, just rebooted or started another one. Yeah.
So that was Blake Burris, I think, who'd done that. But that had just folded. And it was like there was nothing. I was really struggling. And the Apple Docs.
Was Stepwise a thing? Or is it?
Stepwise might have been there, but I'm not sure if I discovered it.
It might have been fading out at that point. Yeah. Like when I came in like 2000, late 90s, early 2000s. Stepwise was kind of where you'd go. But both of those guys are now on the Apple Docs team. So
Yeah. So it's, so that was, so really I thought, okay, I thought I need to get to know stuff. Right. And I just got into podcasting, say just before. So I thought I'm going to start a podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to start this podcast because I have anything to give. I'm going to start this podcast because I need to find out stuff, and I'm going to use this podcast as a way of getting people to talk to me and tell me how to develop for Cocoa. And so I didn't know anybody. I had no idea who anybody was in the community. I'm trying to remember who the first guest was. He was a project manager for the Adium project. What's his name? Chris. Sorry, I will have to send you an email and apologize for not remembering who you were. It's the very first guest. I can't remember
I'm blanking right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh dear. Never mind. I'll find out. I can't remember. I just reached out. I sent an email and I just said, I'm going to start a new podcast and I want you to come and would you come on and just tell me all about how to get into Cocoa is the first episode. And we just recorded it. And I think that was January 2007. And, you know, I thought, okay, that was quite a good overview. That really quite helped me quite a lot, even though he said to himself, he was more of a project manager and was not necessarily that in depth. Mm-hmm. And I just stuck it on iTunes and then just woke up the next morning and thousands of people had downloaded it. And I thought, what? This is, yeah, wow. It's there. And then, over the next, few weeks, and Marcus Zara and Scott Stevenson and Daniel Jelkert and people like that on, who I at the time didn't know they were names in the community. Really, they were just people I'd managed to find somewhere on something. Basically all those guys taught me Cocoa by speaking into my ears late at night, because they were in the US, I was in the UK, so it was called Late Night Cocoa because it was normally 1 a.m in the morning that I was sat there or whatever. It sort of became quite popular, really, and that's how I learned a lot about Cocoa, is by having my own private tuition from all these people.
Well, here's the thing. It wasn't private tuition. It was public tuition. And I think you did a great service to the community as you said, before you started doing that show, there wasn't a lot of shows that covered tech, covered Cocoa tech like that. And, I think you did a good thing by running that show. I think a lot of people learned a lot of stuff.
They did, and people keep coming back to me and saying, actually, a lot of people say to me, I wish you still podcast. I still do, but just not that one. But it's a lot of people say, oh, I wish you'd bring Late Night Cocoa back. But do you know, it's days gone. You know, we have no need to use audio to talk about APIs anymore. And maybe some very high-level stuff and maybe some background stuff and the type of stuff that you guys do and Saul Mora does on NX Brief. But, you know, we were there saying, okay, and you've got this call in the API and this call in the API. Yeah, we've gone beyond that. There are enough websites, enough sample code, enough blogs out there now that's covered. And, you know, it did its job and it's now gone. And I think it's, you know, that type of podcast no longer needed.
Yeah, I agree. This is more of a historical kind of podcast, which is why we don't really go super in depth on the technical stuff. But I think, you know, you did a real service to the community. So thank you for that. The other thing you do is run NS Conference.
Yeah, that came from the same
impetus, right?
Yeah. Impetus, really. That back in the, I've developed over my 26, 27 years as a professional developer. Now I've developed in probably close to 20 different languages across the time for different projects. Some of them that I never wish to see again, and fortunately never will, because they're now dead languages. The two that have really struck me the most have been Object Pascal, Delphi, and Objective C. And it's not actually because they've necessarily been the best languages, although they've been right up there. It's been actually because those languages have a community around them, and they had a very strong community. And back when I was in the Delphi world, I ended up being the technical lead of the UK Delphi user group. And we began to put on a conference, the DCON it was called, here in the UK for Delphi users. And we ran it for 3 or 4 years, I think. Can't remember now, here in the UK. I loved that environment. Mm-hmm. And when I came to, I sort of lost that a bit during my .NET days. And it's not because the .NET community doesn't try or because the .NET community it doesn't care. It was just so big. at the time. And I think, you know, part of what made the Delphi community strong was the fact that it was almost like we're in this together and we're small, we're the underdogs. And I think partly when I came to the Mac, and Cocoa was still in that place. It's not anymore, but it was in that place at the time. Yeah.
I think the core of the community still has that underdog sort of feel to it. I don't think there's any rational reason for that anymore, but it's sort of ingrained. No. It's culturally baked in.
It's because everyone loves an underdog and we all want to be loved, basically. There we are. there's some whatever you call that psychology for you. I have no idea what I'm talking about. And so I was looking around. I think at the time, obviously, you had WWDC, which I'd attended my first WWDC in 2008.
Yeah.
And then I think there'd been one C4 maybe then. This is early 2009, late 2008. I think there'd been one C4 in the US.
Yeah.
And I think there was a conference in Germany called Macoom, which was in German, and therefore no use. So really in Europe, there wasn't really anywhere for people to gather. And so then someone put me in touch with Tim Eisted, who was an indie developer who's now part of the Apple Docs team. Because he was thinking about doing a conference as well. And we sort of threw this thing together, and it was very rough and ready in 2009. We ran it at a university somewhere here in the UK. We had about 90-100 people turn up to it, and everyone loved it, and they said, let's do it again. And so we've done seven now. So
seven? Wow.
Yeah. Six. Yes. No, we've done it for 6 years, and we've done seven, because 1 year we did it in the UK and in Atlanta, in the US, which was absolutely suicidal.
I bet. Yeah.
And again,
you guys do an amazing job. So I attended, not this past year, I think the year before.
Yeah. You were 2012, I think, weren't you?
I think so. Yeah. It's been a while. You guys do an amazing job. And, you know, I organized a conference too, and it's a lot of work, and you guys killed it. It was so well done. So if anybody gets a chance, just go attend Anna's conference. It's worth the trip to Europe.
Forget
the art and the history. Just go for Anna's conference.
I think we have people from 29 countries this year.
Wow.
And speakers from about 20 odd countries. So it was, and I love that side of it. And people say, when are you going to bring Anna's conference to the US? But yeah, the point is, I don't do this stuff to just do it. I do it because I see a personal desire for it and a need. And, you know, in the US over the last few years, you guys have had loads of great conferences spring up, and on, you know, North American continent, full stop, you know, including Singleton. You know, so there's no need. You don't need it. So it's it probably
different. Won't. Yeah. I don't see Singleton and Anna's conference in the same, like, we talk about different things. I don't know. It's like a blog or a magazine or a podcast where I don't really see the only quote unquote competition is like, well, we don't want to hold it on the same weekend.
No. And that's why, like, we coordinate days.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, I don't see them as being in conflict, but there's a lot of rich, really interesting conferences to go to. And I encourage everybody to do it. And in fact, you helped us out this past Singleton. You did all the video editing.
Yeah. It was the best way to guarantee getting a ticket. 'Cause you guys are far too popular. I had to come and work for it. There we are.
Well, I think I could have probably pulled a few strings and got you a ticket if you really wanted. But yeah. But no, thanks a lot. That was great. So
it's one of the things that with NS Conference is it's becoming less technical each year. I'd say, you know, maybe a third of the talks this year were more Singleton style talks and each year that's getting a bit more, and we're doing more business talks and whatever else. And we get some complaints saying they want tech, but again, it's like going back to the same thing with the podcast. The need for someone to sit there and demonstrate an API is going away, because we have lots of screencasts and videocasts and things going on around that now, and Stack Overflow, and the resources are out there. And what isn't out there in the same way, and it's mainly because these sort of things take a lot longer to write and a lot longer to put well, is sort of, you know, far more background information or how I feel about the industry or my experience of this. And I think that's the value that conferences are currently giving as opposed to just pure tech.
Yeah, no, I agree. So, and it's conference. But I want to get back to this RAM objects and C-sharp thing that you were talking about previously. So you learned Cocoa by tricking everybody to, you know, get on your podcast. How did you get into this RAM object thing? Was that like the fact that C-sharp had sort of come to the Mac? Did that interest you? Like, what was the draw?
I got involved with the guys from RAM object sort of middle to late last year, and I just stopped making videos for iDeveloper because I'd been doing training videos for a couple of years, and I just didn't want to do that side as a business for a while. And they got in touch with me and said, would you like to sort of explore coming on board with us as a developer evangelist? And they told me about some stuff they had coming up, which it was still in development then, in sort of, I guess not ultra top secret, but it wasn't really being very public, that they were also working on a cross-platform C#. And I always liked C#. I actually think C# is, you know, it's not a perfect language by any means, but it's a good language to work in. And I was quite interested in what they were doing because, as we sort of touched on when I rushed ahead of myself far too much earlier, they really were just trying to bring C# as a language to each platform that people might want to use it on, while providing, you know, allowing, I say their philosophy about cross-platform development was, you know, it's about making things convenient for the developer where it's sensible, but not at the expense of the user. And, you know, we're firm believers now, because I'm part of it, that, you know, we should be writing apps using the frameworks available on the platform, because that's how you're going to write the best app for that platform. It is our personal opinion. You know, the best way to get a good iOS app or a good Mac app is to use Cocoa.
Sure.
And the best way to get a decent Android app is to use the Delphic APIs, as opposed to trying to produce some sort of cross-platform initiative to work on all of them. If that's what you want to do, there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not the sort of bag into. And it just sort of fascinated me. So sort of got involved, and part of my job is to sort of understand what's going on and just now begin to sort of, you know, start to work out how this can be used and tell people a little bit about it. And just been playing with it really for the last sort of 5-6 months, and sort of I'm really enjoying developing things in C#. And it's quite surreal just writing Cocoa applications in C#. It sort of takes a little while to get used to, because it thinks, well, you know, this isn't right. But it's great. And there's just simple things about it. So it worked really well.
You mentioned that you had to extend the language in order to sort of suit Cocoa a little bit more, not that Cocoa has, or Objective-C has named parameters, but they have a sort of multi-part method names. C# doesn't. And often that's a sore point with a lot of bridges, right? Because you need like underscores and a whole bunch of ugly crap to sort of make it work.
There are one or two areas where that's going to be needed, and we can maybe talk about that if we go in depth on that later. But basically, we wanted the experience to be that if you're going to develop for Cocoa, you should be able to learn Cocoa and just do Cocoa. You shouldn't have to, sort of say, okay, that's what Cocoa says. How do I translate that to this language? Because that's not what the idea was. We wanted to be a first-class citizen where the documentation was relevant and everything like that. So in order to do that, we basically added the syntax to C# that allowed, you know, the Cocoa style, Objective-C style, wherever you want to say they came from, multi-part method names. So it's slightly different. Obviously, the syntax is a little bit different. So application did finish launching with options, for example, would be application, open parentheses, application, close parentheses, did finish launching with options, open bracket, whatever it is, and it's dictionary options. So, but it's the same enough that, you know, you'll be able to see the documentation or the header in the Cocoa things and just write it naturally in C# without
That's pretty
translated,
cool.
Nice. Which and so it works in there, and it's the same with the Dovic APIs for Java. So whatever you would read if you read the Java docs, because one of the things that I did when we were testing the language is I went to the Android tutorial sites and I just followed the tutorials but using C#. And on the whole, there's a few areas where you might do something in Java in a different way because it's using some part of Java that
sure.
really C# doesn't comply. Yeah. But on the whole, the APIs, you can just follow those tutorials but use C# and it works. And you get the same application at the end of it, and it does it all. And that's the goal. So the idea here has been about giving developers the opportunity to write for Windows, write for the Mac, write for iOS, write for Unix through Java platform or Android devices using the same language and the same IDE, but not to try and then take them away from the platform. Let them access the platform fully and write the best platform apps they can.
Right. So that's an interesting proposition. You're not selling a write once, run anywhere kind of thing.
Nope. If you want an Android application, an iOS application, and a Windows application, you're going to write three applications.
Right.
Now
you're selling a not selling, but whatever. The idea is a common tool set, like a common working environment through which you can craft applications for different platforms.
Yeah, I mean, now there could be some common code, but we're not trying to make the sort of the Xamarin claim of 80% common code or whatever, like they do. So it's a different approach. Obviously, non-visual classes. There is an open source library called Sugar that's around the application as well that will do things like create a dictionary that will work on all three platforms. If you want, and sure. if you want to use those classes, you can, but you don't have to. Normally if you're using C# and you declare a string in C#, if you're on Cocoa, you're going to get an NS string. And, if you're on Android, you're going to get the string class there.
If you just type, quote and then start, literally write a string with quotes around it. If you compile against the Mac, it'll be an NS string. And if you compile against Android, it'll be a Java / Delvic native string.
Yep. So basically, but equally, I might want to write my code more Cocoa specific. So I may just abandon the string keyword in C# altogether and just use NS string as an object.
Sure.
It's I can do either in there. So it's it works. And where sensible, we've added things to it. So with the releases just about to come out now, the latest updates, we've added generics into the Cocoa framework. So if you want a typed array, you can have a typed array. But that's your choice. You don't have to use generics, but you can use generics in there. I know things like whether you should have or not have typed arrays is controversial. So we leave it to you.
Well, can you pass one of these into an API from Apple that expects like an NS array, or do you have to coerce them? Or you can?
No, you can pass them in there. And equally, because we do the same as available in C# and .NET. If you want to drop down to C and Core Foundation, you can do. You just have to take over the memory management like you would do if you're using Core Foundation, because it's on top of the C compiler as well.
How would you organize one of these calls into, like, let's say I've got a Core Graphics function I want to call. Do I include the header? Like, do I need to sort of decorate the function or declare it somewhere?
Okay, so basically one of the nice things that we sort of get through it is it is obviously C# supports namespaces. Mm-hmm. So where you might use a framework or have a framework into your application in a Objective-C app, you would just do using Core Graphics or whatever the framework name might be. So brain went blank there for a moment. And that would obviously just include that framework in there. Obviously all the classes in your own application, you don't need to ever include header files for, because they're all in your application's namespace. So that's sure. quite nice. I like that. I'm a namespace fan. but it's in there. But really, if you unless you're trying to do something clever because you want your code to be working on lots of different platforms, because it supports things like, if you really want to, it supports things like, you know, if def iOS, if def Android, if def whatever, if you want to write different sections of code for things. It's not the most recommended way of doing it, but sure, if you want to, you can do it that way. But really, if you're just writing an iOS application or a Mac application, it's going to look, your code is going to look virtually identical to what it would do if you'd written in Objective-C, obviously, but it's just using the C-sharp syntax. So you're getting rid of the square brackets, you're getting rid of the stars for the pointers, because obviously all that stuff is handled differently in there. So it really, it is more about your language familiarity, the way you declare methods, the way you declare your properties is all in C-sharp syntax, but everything else works the same. It's using Arc behind the scene for memory management. So there's nothing, you know, in there. It's really just about getting to use a language with the syntax that you want to use in there, and you're not cut off from anything. I guess one of the, so for example, if you want to work with Zibs, we made the choice, if you're working with Zibs. Now, if you want to write for the Mac, you have to have a Mac, partly because that's a license agreement and it makes sense. But even if you want to write for iOS, you still have to have a Mac, because Apple, even if it was technically possible, Apple say you have to have a Mac. So there, if you're writing for the Mac, there will be a Mac involved somewhere in this, because at the moment, the default IDE for this stuff is Visual Studio. So the part of the idea is we're allowing current C-sharp developers to develop Mac and iOS apps using Cocoa and Cocoa Touch, but from within inside Visual Studio, using the IDE they're already used to and the language they're already used to. And we've got basically using technology we call Crossbox technology. The Visual Studio will talk to a Mac, either a local Mac if you're running in a VM, or it can talk to a Mac anywhere on the network, and it coordinates with it so that you can, when you run your app for debugging, the simulator is obviously going to come up on the Mac, because we can't run the simulator on Windows because it doesn't exist. But you can run the simulator on Mac, or it can run in a device connected to your Mac, but you get inside Visual Studio, you get full debugging, full fix and continue, variable analysis and all the normal stuff you would expect from the Visual Studio debugger while you're doing your iOS app or your Mac app and stepping through the code and having it run on the device or on the simulator exactly as you would expect it to in Xcode, but just using your own IDE. So there's, you know, actually changing IDE is a huge learning curve. If you're a company with 20 developers and they know C-sharp and Visual Studio, not, you know, learning Cocoa is one thing, but learning Cocoa and Objective-C and Xcode is, you know, we've taken away some of the problem for them and allowed them to be in there. So, but as far as the apps are concerned, that you would, I could send you the code for this in C-sharp and you would recognize all the code.
Sure, yeah.
That's the thing.
Like the structure is similar.
Sorry, I was going to say, so for things like Zib support, Nib support, we... there was lots of toing and froing here about, do you do a form builder? Don't you do a form builder? Mm-hmm. And the trouble you've got is, you know, Apple are always changing the format and it's not a documented format. And it's you know, making stuff to go with it. Are we always going to be out of date or whatever else? So what we've actually done for iOS and Mac apps is you will actually edit your Zibs in Interface Builder, or the Interface Builder part of Xcode. What happens is in the Visual Studio project, when you say you want to edit a Zib, we create an Xcode project in the background and we create some Objective-C stubs of the classes that are attached to it. Then when you go to Interface Builder and open it, you can just manipulate it as normal, do all the drag and drop, link things up, link all the outlets and the actions up. And then obviously we take all that when it comes back in and just put it back into the backing into the project in our format. So you actually, all the editing of Zibs goes on in Interface Builder. So we should, in theory, always be up to date.
So the Objective-C stubs just kind of bounce everything back into C sharp code, right?
Yeah. And you can see that when you open the Xcode project in Interface Builder, you can see the stubs in there and everything.
Right. So how much does this use the Objective-C runtime at all?
Yes. Like, it's the initial – okay, now let's get something straight. I am not a compiler developer in any way at all.
Right.
I am developer evangelist, a tester, a sample person, and there's going to at some point but you're going to ask me a question when I'm going to have to say, Guy, I'm stupid. I don't know. So obviously there's, I'm going to keep this as vague as I can, giving you your answer without making me say anything that's wrong.
That's fine.
So obviously, part of the compile, goes ahead through our own compiler, a C sharp compiler, but then, via, the Crossbox technology. So you have a little app called Crossbox running on your Mac. We then pass that stuff over to the LLVM compiler, which then compiles the final code.
Okay.
So the final code is compiled by LLVM. Equally, when we're debugging in Visual Studio via the Crossbox, we're connecting with the, LLDB debugger, and just reading everything from there and just putting it back into Visual Studio in putting the handling breakpoints in exactly the same way. So it really is a full experience. We are currently working on, in the very early stages of working on an IDE for the Mac. So if you wanted to develop for Android and Windows and, iOS and whatever from a Mac IDE, you can do it in there, but that's quite early phases at the moment. We're probably about a month away from an alpha on that.
Wow. Yeah, it's pretty big. I've been on the Mac for a while now, like 15 years. It fascinates me to see people, you know, putting so much time and effort into IDEs and languages in order to develop for the Mac, because for the vast majority of the time that I've been there, it has been sort of the minority platform.
Well, this, I mean, RemObject C Sharp was released on the 1st of March. So that's pretty new. However, yeah, it's based on the Oxygen compiler. Mm-hmm. Now, when we got time for a little bit of history, you didn't say no, so I'm going for it.
No.
Yeah.
Back when Borland, we're going back to Delphi now. Back when Borland didn't make the transition into .NET, the guys at RemObjects wrote an ObjectPascal.NET compiler, which actually later on did get included back into the Delphi project. Product is a separate thing called Prism within the product, and that was called Oxygen. So that was basically a .NET compiler, an ObjectPascal.NET compiler. Which then a few years ago, they extended to also support iOS and, Cocoa and, OS 10, and also support the Java libraries and the Delphic Android libraries. And so this technology, has been available if you wanted to use Object Pascal for a couple of years. So this compiler is probably about 8 years old now and lots of work gone into it. And so really, I don't want to trivialize it because it's been a big job, but actually adding another language to a technology and a platform and a compiler that's already working isn't as big as starting from scratch.
Right.
So really, yeah, you're talking about your parsers and in your syntax parsers and everything again on top. But the actual technology of taking this stuff, compiling it down to CLR or putting it through to LLVM has already been there. And this stuff has been well tested over a few years. And so it's, which is why even though it's a RemObjects, C Sharp is a 1.0, it's probably way ahead of what it should be at that stage. Yeah. Because in there. But it is a big, undertaking. And you know, it's early days. It's, you know, to be honest, it's yet to be seen if anybody's actually going to want it. But you know, only time will tell that. Can't say that now, but I think you know, the expectation here isn't if you're an Objective-C developer, you should just go and drop Objective-C and use C#. I don't think that's the idea here. I mean, if you want to, please feel free to. The idea here is if you're a C# developer and you want to move into other platforms, but you want to move into those platforms, properly using Cocoa, using Delphic, using whatever else, but you want to remain using the tool set that you're already used to and the language you're already used to, here is possibly a good way of doing it.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. It's certainly an interesting idea. I mean, if somebody told me I could use Objective-C and write against the .NET API, I could be interested. That's probably something I would try doing. Although I gotta say, you know what? I really need to spend more time with C# because I don't know. First of all, it keeps coming up on this show. I can't escape it. Second of all, there's a lot of cool things about it. I'm really wedded to Objective-C at this point, but C# has a lot of things to commend it.
Okay, let me give you an example. I agree. If you're an Objective-C developer, I don't have an argument, I'm hopefully not going to get thrown out by the remodels, but I don't have an argument to get you to change to do Mac and iOS development using C#. You have no need to. You're not going to gain anything. In fact, you're going to be at a disadvantage because you've got to learn some things. So, there is no argument for that. However, take my example at the moment where I am developing a Mac and an iOS application. They were started in Objective-C and they're still in Objective-C. And I've now got to do an Android client for it as well. I know Visual Studio. I know C#. I don't know Java. I don't know Eclipse. I'm probably going to do it in C#. Mm-hmm. So I'm now a good use case for the product because I'm going to take a tool I'm familiar with and a language I'm familiar with to go onto a platform I'm not familiar with.
I could see myself doing exactly the same thing. I think I would probably reach for C# rather than going sort of Java, Android stuff.
I would reach for COBOL before reaching for Java. Personally,
really, is Java that bad? I mean,
I'm going to be honest here. My view of Java is probably very unreasonable because, I was involved in some Java products right when Java was brand new, right when it was Swing 1.0. And it's like, and all the abominations that those things were. And once you've been through that sort of pain, it's really hard to recover. It's like an alcoholic being tried to be convinced that this drink won't hurt you.
that's brutal.
it's really interesting stuff, just from my point of view, I just love the whole thing of the technology and sometimes obviously I really hope that this is a commercial success because that supports the company and that's why a lot of I think the people who've spent a long time working on this that'll be a great reward for them to do that, but equally it's been done because it can be done and that's great.
Yeah, that's terrific. I love seeing sort of alternate approaches. And I think this is a good one. It's interesting in that I love that it's just the language. Like you're not trying to foist an entirely new development environment on people. You're trying to support the native environment with a different language, which I think is commendable.
Yeah. But it also means we are always up to date. So Apple were to release, a beta of 7.2 this afternoon, we'd support it this afternoon.
Right.
With the .NET stuff and with the Delvic stuff for Android, because those two, languages themselves behind the scenes support introspection in a really integral way. You just load the new library on and it all works. With iOS or Mac OS 10, we do have to do an import. Basically, we ask you to point a tool at the new SDK and we basically import all the headers and produce all the stuff we need to do from it. But it's only one step and takes a few seconds. Mm-hmm. But it does mean that, because obviously we're not allowed to distribute beta SDKs with the product in any way at all. So it means if you download a beta SDK for anything there or a framework, you can just point it at it and have it imported and be supported in the C# environment.
That's good. Yeah. Pretty fancy stuff.
It's cool stuff, and I like the fact that it is just cool stuff. And it is a little bit weird, but it's quite good fun. And I think Microsoft get quite a bashing sometimes in the Mac community, but I think they've on the whole done a decent job with C# as a language. And
I think so. I've honestly haven't heard much griping about it, which is that's saying something. And I know when they rebooted Visual Basic to get on .NET, everybody was up in arms. But C# itself, I've heard nothing but good things about it. And honestly, I think we spent more time talking about C# on this show than any other language. So
yeah, that's probably not what you were expecting a couple of months ago, is it?
No, no, it really isn't. But I'm happy.
The statistics even more.
Right. No, but I'm happily surprised. That's, you know, sort of, it's the point of having these kind of conversations.
Well, what I love about your podcast is actually, you know, you dig into all sorts of stuff that I possibly wouldn't go and dig into myself, and, you know, bits from people's history, and we all end up far more educated for listening to things like this. So, you know, well done, guys.
Well,
thank you.
Thanks, man. That seems like a good, let's leave on a high note.
Okay. Yeah.
Before we ruin it, say anything stupid.
Before you tell us how much we suck.
No, I'd never do that. I never do that. Not while we're recording anyway. There's too much stuff on here I've asked you to take out that you could use against me.
No, it's fine. Where do we find you, Scotty?
You can find me on Twitter as MacDevNet. I'm on ADN as Scotty. And probably the best website to check out some of the stuff I play with is iDeveloper.co.
Cool.